It is 7 p.m. and it is time to call this meeting to order. This is the regular meeting, a regular meeting, the North Bend Planning Commission, Thursday, October 11th, 2018. This is Commissioner Heller speaking. Who else do we have in the room?
Dick Ryan, Commissioner.
Commissioner McFarland's here.
Commissioner Tao is here.
And staff?
Jamie Burrell.
And Mike McCready.
All right. Next up is approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
All right. Any comments or changes? Okay. All those in favor of approving tonight's agenda, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Seeing none, the agenda is approved. And on to approval of last meeting's minutes. So those are off beside you there. And we can take a moment to do a review here.
Check how many times my name shows up. Must have been because Dick wasn't here.
Yeah, one thing I just wanted to talk with the commissioners about is, I guess Commissioner Miller didn't want to, maybe voted to not extend the meeting. Did others pick up on that? I didn't either.
I don't think it was that formal. I think it was more just she was kind of tired and ready to go, but
I guess I should pay more attention if that is true, and maybe we all can, you know, on everyone. So, just to be clear, because I would have at least noted that or kind of noted her concern and talked to her about it. So I don't know.
Right. We had enough members. I think she could have even excused herself.
We could check
with
her on it.
I chatted with her afterwards, and she did tell me that she was pretty tired.
Okay.
I didn't hear her say anything during the meeting.
It wasn't a strong no.
Yep. It's good that you noted it, so we at least see it in this case.
Well, I move for passage of the previous minutes.
Okay. Second.
All right. Second by Commissioner Tao. And any comments or changes then?
It's good to be. Nothing's jumping out at me.
Okay. All those in favor of approving last meeting's minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
I abstain because of my absence.
Commissioner Ryan was not present, so he'll abstain. So the meeting minutes are approved. Okay, next up, public comment on non-agenda items. If anyone wants to speak on anything that is not the two items we'll discuss tonight.
I came for something else. But I am Elizabeth Davis, and I live at 225 Taylor Avenue South.
Okay.
And I'm here because I thought this was Mike explained that that's not
the
mission tonight, so
is that going on to council?
It's what you had previously reviewed,
Not
the council.
Okay,
sounds
good.
She says
you've
got to go back to council.
I
didn't make that meeting. I
don't know when
you did the meeting. Okay, sounds good.
I don't know what you're going to talk about tonight, so I can't comment.
Tonight, next up is continued deliberation and then recommendation on amendments to the critical area ordinance regulations, North Bend Municipal Code 14.05 through 14.12. So, taking off where we last left off there.
We should really say 14.05. We can leave it as is, actually. We make reference to it in the staff report, the changes that we want to make, which is just in the floodplain chapter, just taking out the direct reference to critical area report, putting that in the common section, and then that's coming to you next with the other changes to 14 as well. So
we're not really all the way to 12?
We did not make any... We did not make any other changes to 12.
Well, I'm just, my question just...
Yeah, it shows
up... We're actually motioning, are you saying that 14-12 is going to come back to us later?
So we're approving it as is right now, but then we'll update it later.
As is, it's in here, let's leave it. But there wasn't substantive changes, it was just a one change that we're actually going to reflect with the edits that Mike's doing. So I am slimming it down when it goes to council. I'm going to not include 14-12 with the critical area amendments, and we're going to show it with his amendments. It's just a
separate.
The summary memo were the items that we went over last meeting, the changes that were made, and referenced page numbers, and then Commissioner McFarland provided an edit to the staff report, which I can show you all, and it was a finding, and so I guess at this point, we can have any more discussion or go over any more questions that you have. And take it from there, but we had good discussion last meeting, and some of the really I just cleaned up the document, corrected as many numerical ordering things as I could. Most of the definitions, if they're not stated so, they are linked to either a FEMA definition or a WAC or an RCW, so it's not always referenced, but we did go back and check a few of those definitions to make sure they match the ones that were called out. Reorganized the financial assurance section on page 19. And the variance section we talked about at the last meeting, and I did ask our legal staff, and they felt like most cities have that. They don't know any that do not. And that it just gives flexibility and protects the city from challenge from a developer. There is kind of ambiguous language in there. But it's meant to be because it's a special circumstance that has to go in front of a hearing examiner. And, I mean, I've been with the city 14 years. I've never seen one. So they're very... I think they'd be very rare.
Mm-hmm.
But they suggested we leave that in. And then there was one other change.
And I think that was, by the way, that was Commissioner Greenberg's
mm-hmm.
question, and he seemed not firm on it, just asked the question. So
yeah, on page 19. I think we brought this up at the last meeting. It wasn't a huge deal, but on page 19, 1405.045A4, it says for structural projects, example, compensatory storage outside of a wetland or stream or security shall be released upon completion and city acceptance of the work. I talked to legal about that word structural because it didn't really make sense to me. Is that important? Why is it there? And this is existing language that we have. And they agreed, so I think we can remove the word structural, and it's just, if projects are outside of a wetland or stream buffer, then the performance assurance can be released once it's completed. Makes sense.
So you're just suggesting striking the word structural,
right.
Not the whole. Yeah.
Right, just
okay.
Structural. And that came out after I had already printed this, so.
While you're on that page, Jamie,
mm-hmm.
I have... question. It's actually a fairly similar question in two different locations. So A2,
mm-hmm.
we're giving a range of
cost.
What's the thinking behind a range instead of fixing it?
I don't think there was one, and that's not typically what we see. You're right. So I think we could say...
So for the applicant, it's kind of like, well,
yeah.
Who's making this decision and what's it based on?
Right.
Is it because I'm that's liked by the city or I'm not liked by the city?
Right.
Or, whatever.
We can say a minimum of 125%. 5%. Take the low end and call that the floor. No, you were gonna go further.
No, I would definitely not go there.
Yeah.
I would prefer that we just state a number.
What it is, okay.
Or if we're going to stay with a range, I think we need to go into something more that says what that is based on and who makes the determination. I assume the director, but it doesn't specifically say that.
Yeah, let's just pick a number that either one, I mean.
And what is, and I guess it first goes to, why would it be anything above the cost of restoration? The thinking I would, I'm gonna guess for you, is to allow for cost increases, inflation and such, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Rent, or Mike, isn't the landscape, isn't it 150%?
I believe it is.
So, to be consistent with that, we could just say 150%.
And I'm comfortable with that.
That sounds good.
Okay.
Sorry, I just, the range just struck me as.
Yeah, that's a good catch. That might have been left over from when the consultant was giving us choices and we didn't choose, so let's do that.
Similarly, in B2, we say assurance shall be in about 20 to 30%. In this instance, I would go the lower, I think.
Yeah.
It's fairly low.
I think that's consistent with landscape too.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go with 20.
Everybody over?
Yep, that makes sense.
Catch.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I am following the instructions that I heard a couple meetings ago. We're not here to dot the i's and cross the t's anymore. We're here to talk about overviews and things. I'm gonna try and keep my conversation to that.
If you got minor corrections, though, go ahead and email them to us.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, but I did, thinking as a public reader rather than as a commission reader, and I wasn't here, and then I'm going back to page 6 under the definition of critical facility. A homeowner might wonder why their home isn't considered a critical facility. And I'm wondering if we could be a little more clear of what critical facility is, that it's a publicly owned building, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's most likely just directly out of the WAC, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
It's a pretty.
Yeah, I know that, you know that, but if I was Joe, homeowner, home builder, I just might wonder why my home isn't considered a critical facility, because it is to me. And by identifying it as a publicly owned building, if that's what they are, that would help add clarity to that kind of a definition.
Yeah, I'll see if I can do that.
It seems to mostly be about public, but a nursing home wouldn't necessarily be.
Publicly owned or public tenanted.
Maybe if it just cited that per the WAC, right? I mean, it'd be, there are a number of references above for other sections referencing the WAC, so maybe just add the WAC.
It makes sense to me, critical facility, if it's in reference to schools to a degree, but especially like police, fire, hospitals, you know, things that we can't really kind of keep moving and staying alive and surviving, having order.
I'm trying to practice law without a license. That's all.
That's the fun of being on the commission.
That's what I'm trying to say. I felt like I had nothing really to add to this, except I have a lot of goods, you know, just really well written, well, very clearly written, understood.
Yeah.
So I think we've been really pleased as well from the staff perspective of what the consultants done to simplify and streamline.
Yeah, so I found it easy to read because I wasn't trying to find the mistakes. I was trying to read it for what was there.
Overall, yeah.
Yeah, so I just found it to be a, you know, very clear and very appropriate document.
Do you have more in the document?
Yeah, I don't.
Would you share with your commissioners?
Yeah, so Rob, in the findings, I'll just make sure I didn't, I'll give this out to you for the staff report. I did change the critical critical area, recharge area, we had some language in there about best management practices and such. I talked to the consultant again, I was like, but we didn't make any changes in this chapter. They agreed. So I just changed it to our current family working system. And the changes were just, again, referencing that critical area report. And then I put in your discussion last meeting about the stream buffers. The reference that the floodplain management section will be reviewed by the Planning Commission next. And then the shoreline, we're going to come back to you with that chapter. Once the critical areas get gelled and I get direction from council, this will be also, by the way, at their meeting on Tuesday. If anybody's able to make their committee meeting Tuesday at 4 o'clock, they're going to be really just talking about wetlands, streams, and buffers. I'm starting them with that. That's the meat of it. And then the next meeting in November or December, probably a November meeting, I'll bring them the whole code.
That's why our box is full.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a thick package, not because of this. So number, summary and findings four. Rob had proposed, or Commissioner McFarland proposed, basically, I had the last sentence in this paragraph, but just to give a little more meat to the finding and our consultation with ESA and best available science review. So I thought that was a good insert for the staff report.
Just in number one, the last sentence. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying?
Number four.
Oh, number four.
I had the last sentence in here, and
okay.
The rest is new.
I see.
New language.
And basically, my thought was, as I read the memo and referenced, this is what we did. We based an awful lot of our review on their input. And
right.
Thought we should be speaking to
them. Yeah. No, I thought it was good. That's a good answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
good
hiring.
I'll saw make a motion.
I'm just moving us along. Would you entertain a motion, Mr. Chair?
Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about, Dick?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Yes, let's
make a. I can make a motion to approve.
Chair, I move to approve the staff report and amendments to Critical Areas Regulations, North Bend Municipal Code 1405 to 14.11, as amended tonight. I'll second the motion.
Second by Commissioner Tao. We've already kind of said we don't have any comments, but any finals in there?
Mm-hmm.
All right. All those in favor of approving the amendments to critical area regulations, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Seeing none, motion approves. It's unanimous. Okay.
Great, yeah. So, like I said, I think the council committee will talk about it on Tuesday. I think they will talk about the stream buffers. So if there's interest to that, one of you guys could be able to come to kind of speak to your recommendation for the King County buffers. I think that might be a point they want to talk about. And they're not going to have a lot of time. It's a big agenda. They don't have a lot of time. So we're not expecting an answer from them or a vote or anything. They'll probably bring it up at their next meeting and have more discussion. But
creek don't rise, I expect I'll be there.
Yep.
So as a new council commissioner, compliments to the staff for the process. This is a very helpful process, the way you started off with kind of the overview and the consultant's report, and allowed us to have some discussion, ask some questions, and kind of hone in on what the key points were, and then ultimately get to voting on it today. So I really appreciated the process.
Yeah, if we could have a consultant for every task.
Well, that was really just nice. Part of the process. No, I would not recommend a consultant for every project. but just the kind of the thought process coming in without a lot of background on the work that the commission and the council have done previously, I found very helpful.
Exactly. I would second that. You guys you're the ones that guide the process, even though they did the background work, so to speak, and compliments to them. They really did a great job on that.
But
it is in how you tee up the subject and guide it through.
Yeah, and we are working on the maps now, so when I get those draft finalized, I'll share them with you.
So the CED meeting said is what's next, and they're going to take a look at...
They'll take a look and just focus Tuesday on just streams and wetlands.
Just next Tuesday?
Next Tuesday, yeah. 16th.
At what time?
4 o'clock. Okay. They won't see the entire code. The ordinance is going to take a little bit of time for me to draft and then for legal to draft or to review. So I was thinking January probably is when they'll adopt it, but we'll see if we get it done before then. So they have November and December, assuming we keep both of our committee meetings, which we probably will based on the work, or we can adjust it until we...
Considering the effort that our consultants and staff and this commission went through, I'm sure that the council will be able to move much more expeditiously than that.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take off. I'm not
staying. And then we'll have a big part two to this coming up in a couple months. So the Shoreline Master Program will follow a lot of the amendments that we've done in the inquiry regulations, so that'll come for you guys.
It should be... That should be simple because you've already done all the hard work. So we'll just be dotting I's and crossing T's on that one, just making sure it references me and looks good.
I won't be here for that.
Oh, darn. But yeah, I'll have that loaded up. So.
All right, so the next one is just some fairly minor amendments. One of them will be what Jay was talking about, cleaning up that end section of the 1412 amendments for consistency with our critical area updates to consolidate our critical area regulations into one place, for our critical area submittal regulations into one place, and not have them scattered throughout floodplain and streams and wetlands and so forth. The primary thing here, though, is back in 2008, FEMA was sued by the National Wildlife Federation for failure to comply with the Endangered Species Act with FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program. So there was a lot of back and forth between FEMA, the federal courts, and Fish and Wildlife Service about how are we implementing this. And ultimately what came out of this was what's called the biological opinion, which was the method by which FEMA was going to comply with ESA by updating the requirements of the National Flood Insurance Program and associated community rating system and minimum requirements for floodplains, jurisdictions with floodplain regulations. So part of that is a requirement that for projects that have floodplain permits that are within the floodplain, they're required to provide a biological opinion on, habitat assessment on the impact of the project on listed species. So this is specifically Chinook salmon and the Puget Sound resident killer right whale. A long ways downstream from here, but we're in the floodplains that are contributing to our quality, which then contributes to salmon habitat, which the orchid eat. So in the end, we're also obligated to comply. So we've got a floodplain consultant, Christina Woman from Petit, has put together some amendments that address our submittal requirements for these habitat assessments. What does it look like? What's the process for reviewing it? And how does the city address that? So that's what the meat of these amendments before you guys are. As a part of that, there are also some maps in here that are required to implement some buffer provisions that are also in this biological opinion. That's the two maps showing. Exhibit B is the protected area. And Exhibit C, and these two maps were prepared by our consultant. We're going to wrap them into the floodplain regulations. What Exhibit C does is it establishes the riparian habitat zone. And that by itself is not used for the purpose of our regulations other than to establish part of what the protected area is. And the protected area which you can see in Exhibit B in the green, is an area that we're required by this biological opinion to locate structures out of wherever possible. It's kind of goofy in an urban context in that we've got downtown lots. You don't exactly move something away from a downtown. It's not feasible. You have your property boundary within that protected area. You can't move it out. You can't buffer it outside of it. But where it is possible, for example, if you've got a large property, part of it's in, part of it's out, you're supposed to locate that structure outside of that protected area. So one of the regulations in here is just specifically that, a buffering requirement to locate it.
And the protected area is essentially just following the 100-year floodplain?
It's not. It's the greater of the riparian habitat zone, which is 200 feet from the location of the regulations here.
There is something there, like, it's like,
it's in the definitions
there. Page 1. Yeah.
Page 1. Riparian habitat zone is 250 feet from the ordinary high water mark. Type S streams, 200 feet from type F streams, 100 feet from type F streams less than 5 feet wide, 150 feet to 225 feet for type N streams, depending on slope stability.
And that's a brand new definition. Is this something written by the consultant out of their experience, or this is from the negotiation?
These come directly from the biological opinion.
Okay, so this is what got this these.
It's coming from above.
It's a requirement.
Yeah, out of that lawsuit, this was part of the negotiation, and so this is being handed down to us.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
It's a question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I'm probably one of maybe four owners of property in this town that is developed inside the floodway, because I'm protected by a revetment wall that was installed before the 1972 Shoreline Act. I couldn't find any remediation or any comment about that particular structure. My structure should need repair. I don't think I'm covered by that, by this code.
So your structure is just considered a legal non-conforming use, so you can maintain it, repair it, as long as that repair, as long as the damage doesn't exceed 50% of the valuation of the structure before the damage. And that's under state law. If you exceed that threshold, you're not allowed to do that repair, and you'd have to remove the structure. So that's statewide, anything that's in the floodway.
So removing the structure would put me directly in the path of a flood. That'd be ludicrous to do that.
Oh, you're not talking about
home.
Home, you're talking about a shoreline.
No, I'm saying that I have a shoreline feature. Maybe you haven't seen my property, but I have a shoreline feature on the Little Fork.
Okay.
Two of us have, myself and my neighbor, have this wall. But the former owner of the Tanner Mill owned the property, and he knew the law was coming, so he built this shoreline revetment wall.
Yeah.
And that protects us from a 15-foot flood, which protects our home. Our home was built right down on the shoreline, as a matter of fact. So so we're going to get strictly, we'd be impacted by a flood if that wall gave, frankly. But it seems to me that that wall, because it was built prior to the Shoreline Act, that we're protected, and we have insurance for it, that kind of thing. But in this code, it doesn't provide protection for us to repair it. That's the best I could read the code. I couldn't see that.
Yeah, so that actually, I think, would be under the critical area regulations, or the shoreline critical area regulations specifically. There's a section in there about revetments and shoreline stabilization measures. So that's not what you just reviewed. It's what will be coming to you in about 2 months.
Okay.
To follow up for the critical area.
So I shouldn't rely upon this document to cover that.
No, the flood regulations are more about impacts on structures in the floodplain and fill.
I hate to talk about my personal problem in a commission meeting, but
I'm curious though. You are talking about the wall and not your house.
Yeah, just the wall.
Okay.
The wall.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Holds the flood back.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Good clarification there.
And it's in 1420. If you're curious to look at that, just what it reads now. So 1420 is our shoreline regulation. So if you go to that, Then there'll be a section on shoreline stabilization, and you'll see all the existing regulations that address those measures.
Okay.
Yeah, so my group just, even though they always endeavor to not talk about it personally, it, in this instance, it's a great example of what we need to be mindful of, and that there's two different things. What I'm gathering is that how the what's it called?
The revetment wall
is treated under the shorelines code because it's in the shoreline could be different than the way the home or other structures on the property might be treated within the flood plain.
This is an aside. Our home was built off Tanner Road down, down in the one of the former baselines where the river used to flow. It's totally flat. You see, that's where the river was a million years ago, maybe. We're right down there. All the homes around us are up on the road.
Oh, I know where you are.
You know right where I'm at. Yeah. And it's an interesting thing to think about. But there must be other homeowners in the valley who have been here, whose homes have been built, you know, in the prior 68 period, that have the situation too, that where they've gotten, they like to be down by the water, and they just built the wall to protect themselves, and there it is.
Yep. No, it's still allowed. We just permitted a shoreline stabilization 5 years ago or so. There are a lot of thresholds that you have to cross to get there. Environmental mitigation, making sure that you're not creating flood impacts to others.
Yeah.
But it's still legal.
Well, taking it to a much larger case, that I mean, to me, the analogy would be we've got a unapproved. What's the right? It's, you know, our dikes that protect most of the town are not approved, right? And so the question would be, if we had an event that breached the dike or damaged the dike to a significant degree, would you legally be allowed to go back there and repair that, do you lose all of Silver Creek?
You can repair it. And King County has got two projects currently active right now to do weather repairs.
But is that being isolated? Is that something that they've stepped forward and said, okay, because it's this levee and because there's a great deal of the town involved? Or are they saying, as just a matter of course, in other words, is there some difference line that would be drawn between an individual homeowner that's isolated in a location versus the ones that could affect large swaths of the
town? There is. There's separate regulations addressing levees and shoreline stabilization.
Rob, when was it? Was it in the pretty nice when we had that major flood? Well, both cities were always fighting each other, came together and demanded that the levees be reinstalled.
It was 90, I think, was the biggest flood that I'm aware of.
It was horrendous down in Snoqualmie, but even North Bend got impacted severely.
Yeah.
And it's because the county was following through with the process of removing a lot of these protected areas because they were trying to strictly follow the Shorelines Act, which put a lot of property owners in danger. And when that flood hit, people came out. I remember the we had a joint town meeting overflowing. People were just roaring mad about the county cutting back on replacing or repairing all those levees.
Now they are actively maintaining them.
And not dredging the water beds and that kind of thing. Just let the rivers rise. Seemed to be ludicrous. And face all the development that was going on.
Well, just to go back to the floodway thing, I thought I might have heard that floodway building is still allowed.
No.
Okay, that's what I thought. I was reading in here that it's not, you can't, even if you build a revetment wall, you still can't.
You can't build anything new in the floodway.
Right, okay.
You can maintain.
Yeah, maintain is
there. Was up to 50% of the value of the structure.
In a related, you know, why I think it's good to talk about some individual cases in a sort of a different case. I had a client who was selling a property in Silver Creek some years back, and a corner of the home is in the floodway, and the rest of the home is just in the flood plain. And we went to the city to get a ruling on, well, what happens and what can be done on this property? Can you add, you know, on to the property? Because some potential buyers were considering enlargement. And so we went through kind of that exercise. And if I recall, the answer came back that if there's damage, the portion of the home that's in the floodway cannot be rebuilt. The rest of the home in the floodplain could be rebuilt. Is that? Do you remember that?
I haven't considered that question specifically.
I think that was essentially the answer, was, which kind of goes to what you were saying, was that if it's in the floodway,
right,
there's no rebuilding. And so it was kind of, in this case, it was kind of odd because they were literally talking about like a third of one bedroom was in, you know, technically in the floodway. And so it was okay, if something were to happen that would bring you toward that 50% mark, you're going to have a pretty odd shaped house in
this bedroom.
So it's how some of these things can play at you unintentionally.
Floodplain regulations is not something that we have a lot of latitude with. We are a part of the community rating system. You've got some latitude with what the requirements are. The stronger that you go, the lower the higher community rating system, the lower the point value that you are, which raises the insurance discount that you receive.
Climbing the ladder.
Slowly but surely.
And I think.
So, yeah, this was just a real brief introduction. Christine is actually going to be here at the next meeting, we'll have a public hearing, and she'll go over the opinion with whoever is here from the public, and we'll seek your recommendation on it after that.
Could you just in the two, so I understand now that exhibit B flowing from that definition that you pointed out, which came from on high. Help me with the interpretation of exhibit C. What is the red showing me? It's saying a riparian habitat zone, but is that similarly being derived from the agreement that was made and passed down to us?
So both the riparian habitat zone and area are terms and concepts provided in that biological opinion, and there's different regulations that apply to different contexts. In our context, we're not required to do certain things that are required otherwise in the protected area, because being in an urban location and also being upstream from the falls gives us some leeway because we're not providing direct habitat, mm-hmm. but there's still this buffering requirement to be outside of that protected area where possible.
You can see on the Middle Fork, there are two commissioners sitting at this table have homes in that red zone. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes...
And the protected area. So it's just...
You're up on the road.
But it's, yeah, well, I'd have to get a tape measure up to see ordinary high water mark to 250 feet away.
Yeah.
But that's related to the protected area, which seems like it does have regulations. And in the I think it's the staff report, page 2, just says that there are no regulations specific to the riparian habitat zone. And that's what you had said, because we're so far from Chinook and they're not jumping 250 feet up the waterfall.
It's a lot more complicated if you have direct habitat than there's... provisions about not clearing more than 65%. You remember the old King County rule when they were updating their critical area regulations? That was so common.
Okay.
Being required.
Okay.
If you're in more rural contexts and if you're providing direct habitat.
I see. All right. I had a question just on the doors 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
I just briefly typed that in Google and nothing hit on that because I was like, that's kind of a weird term. So is that their
so
language?
Three approaches to meeting the requirements of this biological opinion. So the door 1 is just to use the direct model language provided in that biological opinion for your floodplain regulations. And it's pretty draconian. It's not something that we could reasonably apply with an urban context like North Bend. It's got very strict clearing limits, limitations on size of building, very specific stormwater requirements that don't necessarily work in an urban area. So it's not feasible for us. The door number 2 is demonstrating that your existing regulations or amendments, and your not just your flood regulations, but your comprehensive suite of regulations, including your critical areas, your open space acquisition, all sorts of things, are enabling you to demonstrate no impact to these two different species. And that's what we're probably going to go after. Right now we're in the door 3 approach, which is where you require habitat assessment for every project that has a floodplain permit. And that's what this habitat assessment amendments are, and here is just clarifying more about that process and what's required for submittal.
I could see property owners just being overwhelmingly something at the notion of doing a habitat assessment for orca.
Yeah, it is.
I get the science and the logic, the common sense.
Practical.
The practical is.
Yeah. What we've done is created a habitat assessment template document that developers and homeowners can use that very much simplifies it. So we're saying we're above the falls, therefore we're just providing water quality. Where this project conforms to the King County Surface Water Design Manual. It's not providing, it's in an urban context, so we're kind of laying out the findings about why it doesn't create impacts to these species, and they just then have to fill in some basic information about the project, and that then serves as their habitat assessment for this purpose.
How does it, if it does, interact with CEPA? It sounds very analogous to CEPA.
Yeah, it's just different processes, different standards. So CEPA comes from the state, this comes from the feds. It's frustrating because there's so much overlap between this and critical areas, overlap between critical areas and CEPA. Each has its own required process that has
to be followed. But even CEPA is an outgrowth from feds, so could we?
It's the state's equivalent of NEPA.
Right.
Mm-hmm. National Environmental Policy Act.
Right.
Mike, I did note the I, dotting the I thing here, problem on page 13 and 15. You left out item C. Either it's D's misnumbered, you missed out putting that C in. You have A, routine maintenance, B, removal of noxious, and then there's no C.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's probably just a typo there.
And then I have a question. I see language of special flood hazard areas. It's page 2. It could be in other places. And then the protected area. You know, so are those the same thing, different words, same definition, different agency describing?
So special flood hazard area is a term by FEMA directly, and that means anything that's regulated in the floodplain. So it's the 100-year floodplain and the floodway and the subzones within those areas. So there's other areas that are mapped for flooding potential up to 500-year flood, but that's not considered special.
Well, okay, so based on what you just said, then let's go to page one and the protected area. Mm-hmm. How does that differ?
The protected area is this concept, not necessarily for regulation of floods, mm-hmm. but for implementation of this biological opinion standard okay. on impacts to species.
Yeah,
it's the same place, but it has two different. Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, yeah.
It is the protected area is a much smaller area within the larger special flood hazard area.
Okay.
So, you've got the flood map. Let's see it. Flood map. I've seen it before.
Yeah.
It takes over most of work that is the historic mm-hmm. open. Oh yeah, so that the special flood hazard area is shown on Exhibit C in that light pink color, the 100-year flood.
Yeah, and it's I guess it I finally figured out it's not labeled, but it's shown in B as well.
Mm-hmm.
For the most, it's kind of in a
protected area, all the green.
And then we can see the protected area. So, okay, that helps.
Like I said, we're going to wrap these two figures into the code in the next round that you guys see for the public hearing.
Okay.
One other amendment that will be in your packet for the next one is we just got comments from FEMA on this, and they were good with it. They had just one minor language edit to make it read a little more directly. Didn't change the meaning of anything. So I'll wrap that in, provided that in the next packet.
Okay, so on the accessory structures, because I see residential and non-residential and accessories kind of in between there, so do you need to do a floodplain permit and habitat assessment, the accessory structure? Page 9.
So we have specific exemptions for what doesn't require the full habitat assessment.
Okay.
And let me find where that is.
Yeah,
14.12.210. It's got some exemptions in it. So the non-development activities, so that's maintenance, remodeling, repairs, expansion of existing structure. So it would be required. But that's where we have a checklist for very simple projects.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that it's basically just filling in the blanks on the information that serves as your habitat assessment.
Okay.
It's very straightforward.
And that's where you say if a floodplain development permit fee is waived if the structure is under 200 feet in size.
That
page 3. Because there's a lot of people, like, I have some friends that live on 6th Street, for example. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of homes, you know, that are in the floodplain. So mm-hmm. if they want to just build a shed, then there's quite a bit to do. Maybe not quite a bit, but something.
There's a distinction between building a shed on site and buying one at Home Depot and bringing it in. Either way. And
we have what we also call a placement permit, which is not so much a review permit, but it's basically just giving them, here's the rules that apply. You've taken and received these rules, you'll comply by them. And that way it's the onus on them to make sure they're placing their shed
right.
appropriately. In the floodplain, we can't do that. We actually have to do the floodplain permit for it because of potential mm-hmm. for it to, if there was a flood,
flood
cause damage to somebody else.
They make nice arcs.
So yeah, this fee-exempt floodplain permits, those things don't require the habitat assessment. Not okay. giving stuff just inside the house or maintenance kind of activities.
Okay. All right.
Anything else? Questions, comments?
So Christina is really the expert on this stuff, so she'll be here for next week.
And
I've read a lot of these, like all you guys have, they read well. It feels like it covers your bases. It feels like there's enough teeth in it to keep things running. I mean, I don't see anything that jumps out at me. That's how I begin to read these things now. If it really hits me, you know, then something's wrong. But never, you know, this looked pretty good. So congratulations.
There's nothing overly scary in this.
No.
We're implementing what we have to in this biological opinion.
Yeah.
But it's not.
But I look at it to see if the average guy or gal can read it and make sense out of it, because that's who it's written for. And I think it's easy to discern. Well, that's good work.
Can you go over the next two meetings? I see some tentative agenda items there.
So your next meeting will be just the public hearing on this floodplain stuff. And then after that, we're going to start talking about affordable housing and more specifically workforce housing, inclusionary housing. I don't know if you've heard about that.
That's a new term. Yeah.
So that's a requirement that you can apply to subdivisions, perhaps over a certain size, that they include either a percentage of their units at certain affordability levels, or that they contribute in some other manner to affordable housing. So it could be some kind of fee applied to homes over a certain value. There's a number of ways to do it, but it's the overall goal is to provide means for people to afford to be able to live in the community. It's not necessarily subsidized housing, but there's a whole suite of tools that you can use to promote housing affordability. And David Motor's going to just provide kind of an informal work session with you guys to lay out some options, and he'll seek your direction on which options we're most interested to pursue to put into code.
Who's that? David, director. Yeah. Oh, I heard a different name. I thought, oh, there's somebody else there.
On the 25th, depending on what kind of input we get at the public hearing, is that a meeting where we would potentially take action on this floodplain, or is it just another step in a series of...
Since these are pretty straightforward amendments, after the public hearing, unless there's something major that you want to consider from what you heard from the public, we look for your deliberation and action.
Okay.
Could be a short meeting.
Okay. I'll fix it.
All right. Got to have someone speak at the public hearing.
I like floodplain stuff.
Good.
I have floodplain stuff. I added onto my house when they did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Anything for the good of the order?
I do.
What?
Just take us to 9 o'clock. good of the order. I had time yesterday I took the time to drive the community. I haven't driven it for quite a while. I was looking at where things are being built, what's going on. And what I'm seeing is more of the same. We're not leaving trees. And it's becoming very, very conspicuous. And I don't know what the hell's going on.
So what you're seeing is what was vested to our prior tree regulations. So you recall the Planning Commission 3 months ago or something reviewed and recommended on amendments to our tree regulations. The council has since adopted those regulations, and those are now affecting developments from here forward. But there's still a lot of development that was vested to those prior regulations, and so you'll still continue to see some additional developments that are developed under those old regulations. We're doing as much as we can under those old regulations to protect the trees that we can.
We're going to be built out before we have those regulations come into effect. We're going to be built out.
There's nothing that we can do about that. When you vest, you're bound to those regulations, and you can't apply new regulations.
So, all right. So.
But we are
being
very stringent with developers now about making sure they're providing the tree protection fencing and we're imposing penalties if they damage trees within that.
The only tree that's been protected is the big fir tree by the new city hall. That's the only tree I've seen protected with orange
netting.
Well,
oftentimes there's, like out at Sedale, there's a lot of trees that are actually being protected, and you just don't see it because you see the kind of mass clearing limits within that area. So at Sedale, there's quite a large swath of trees that are protected on the outskirts of the development and one stretched through it.
Okay. So I've been there. I went up to that area. And, of course, everything inside the center of that is just gutted, as it should have been. It's just rock piles. You know, I understand that it wasn't even solid ground that those trees are growing on, so I get that. But I looked in that area very carefully, and I noticed there's a timbered strip easterly of Wood River that's just on the city line. It's a nice wooded strip in there. It clearly is going to be developed at some point. It's got no trespassing signs on it. And every friggin' tree in that inside that area is marked.
Yeah.
So marked. It's flagged. And I, as a logger, I know what that means.
No, that's a tree survey. And that
no, it's not a tree survey. You don't mark every tree for a survey. You do that on a sampling basis. Every tree is flagged.
He's talking a different survey, Dick. He's talking about the significant tree survey that the developer's got to do.
Really?
Yeah, because you've got a development application on that. Right?
Yeah, so that property specifically will have the most stringent tree requirements of anything in the city.
It's got to have. It's under a constrained low-density zone,
yeah,
right. So it's got to be.
Yeah.
If trees start coming down from there, I'm going to sue the city, personally.
Yeah.
So we have what's called our low-impact demonstration subdivision regulations that applies to that site. And the whole idea of those regulations is to protect the forested character. And we use Beaux-Arts as an example of what that should look like, where you have very minimized roads that kind of meander through the trees, so it has more of a campground feel than a subdivision feel.
That one came through us. I didn't know where you were talking about at first, but yeah, of the whole Wood River subdivision. Yeah,
that is the most beautiful community.
Mm-hmm.
And if this happened next to them, my God,
sure.
there'd be hell to pay.
Yeah. One of the last forested
and
areas.
The other problem that struck me on that was that single strip of homes along the north line of Wood River. Again, that's out of character of that property. These are four to an acre large homes, 4 foot setbacks along Miner's Ridge. Why the hell was that ever allowed? Isn't there something about conforming or some kind of thing in our code that says you have to build not to similar to the neighboring property? This is...
That was the zone in effect for that property.
It was one strip.
Well,
100 feet deep.
A weird,
even Wood River is within our low-density residential zone, so people there should... I'm sure a homeowner association wouldn't allow that, but they could potentially subdivide their properties into four per acre.
Whoever permitted that should have been kicked off the job. Period.
It's been zoned that way since it came into the city.
Damn it. Well, if I keep seeing this happen, Mike, I'm on this commission, but I'll be walking from it. I can't understand.
Well,
how we can allow that to happen.
The Planning Commission and the Council did consider that issue about 2 years ago, and that's when the constrained low-density residential zone was created to provide that more rural character, rural feel, larger lots along some of the furthest edges of the town. So that includes that property east of Wood River. If you look at the map there, it's the diagonal stripe.
Yeah.
So basically everything that's left.
Yeah.
That's in the...
I get that, but I saw those trees flagged, every single tree. Even the smallest trees were flagged.
Yeah, it doesn't mean they're being removed.
And better not be. I'm a logger. I help develop Snoqualmie Ridge. You know I'm not a no-develop kind of a guy, but I'm a follow-the-rules kind of a guy, and that strip east of Wood River is Mm-hmm. Got to be protected.
And that's why we have those.
It's got to be protected.
The low impact subdivision regulations.
Yeah. Or our rules don't mean anything if we can't get something out of our code. We have a code, and still things happen that is from the prior code. I'm getting fed up with that. Up to here with that. That's my good of the order. Let's go across and get a beer.
Let the record show that Commissioner Ryan's a little red in the face. my item, the only one to mention, because we mentioned in an upcoming meeting we'll be talking about affordable housing, we're kicking off the next round of that conversation, Dave Miller and I, at our business outreach meeting next Thursday, 7:30 in the morning. And that's a forum that we created to help keep commercial property owners and commercial business owners informed of changes coming to the city and get feedback on what's working for them and not. And the request came from that group to focus on affordable housing, and so that was a great ask of them, and so that's a good thing. And then so we'll be talking about it here, which is another great thing. And I know that council has already spent some time chatting in a workshop about it and is planning, is it November's work study?
Yeah.
A whole session on affordable housing. And so all of us should be paying a lot of attention to that and being engaged in how to help others that aren't in those four of the unit areas. That's mine.
Gary?
No.
Do you interest groups like Rotary and Wellness, get them interested in coming to your meetings and that kind of thing?
I haven't specifically reached out to those social organizations because this particular group is you know, its focus was kind of on the commercial and business, although we welcome.
But I mean, if you go to their breakfast meetings or whatever
and
just announce you're doing this.
Announce we're doing it. Yeah, no, I haven't done that. Great idea.
Speak to Lisa at the Chevrolet store. She'll get you on the phone. Yeah, I do too.
So moved.
I had one.
Oh, sorry.
on Tanner Road, Mike, there's a line cut to the river, mm-hmm. and I think you've mentioned that they're going to be doing like a stormwater conveyance pipe through there. I don't remember that in the original passage. Is that?
It was, yeah.
And is that something, because that, so basically I guess the summary would be that the development is not able to kind of mitigate or contain their water on site, so they're going to be dumping storm water into the river?
It's an overflow. It's an emergency overflow. The intent is with those bioswales that they are infiltrating,
mm-hmm.
but should we have the 100-year storm, it's got to be able to go somewhere. So that's the overflow
mm-hmm.
in the worst-case scenario.
But is it being filtered?
How often would you expect water to be coming, you know, through the pipe into the river? Like once a year, every other year?
I'm not the stormwater guy, so I really can't.
I guess it's just something, are we going to be doing that at other developments throughout the city?
It's allowed under the King County Surface Water Design Manual if you're within a certain distance from the river.
Mm-hmm, the development.
Discharge.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still containment and retention requirements associated with it. It's not just dump whatever into the river. It's
mm-hmm.
you infiltrate, you contain, you slowly release into the river. And this is, just a maximum flow overflow scenario.
But it could already be an issue. You know, we already have flooding in the river, and it's contributing to downstream flooding, right, to North Bend and elsewhere. I'm just curious.
I don't want to get into it because I'm not a stormwater reviewer and I'm not familiar enough with it.
Yeah, I can follow up maybe, but just to see it, just be curious how frequent that is. If it is 100-year, happens it once every 100 years, right? So is that going to happen?
100-year flood is 100-year storm.
It's frequency.
When everybody is in the water.
Yeah. Okay.
Most regulation goes to, I believe, the 30-year flood.
You designed to the 100. You were required to design for how you're going to handle the 100, right? So, but you've described it accurately. The 100-year is when you expect the overflow to kick in. Right? And it has to do with totally the number of inches that fall within a certain period, whether it's going to overwhelm the system or not.
The other part of that system you're talking about, Scott, is also cities promoting a surface trail on top of this pike to go to the river. So where are the visitors going to park their cars on Tanner Road to go to that?
There's additional parking being provided along Tanner Road on the developer's property, within the right of way.
Evidently you're having two of these, right? There's one that's coming right in behind the trailer park.
Yeah.
There's no parking lot there. There's no parking lot there. I know the road. There is parking space further up by the abandoned easement that goes to the river from where the old bridge was.
I don't believe the one that is behind the trailer park is any trail associated to the river there.
There's a stormwater outflow there from the Tanner Falls subdivision, which is going in next to Tannerwood.
Mm-hmm.
I saw where the pit is now.
That won't have any public access.
Is that going to be elevated? Is there going to be a drop with the water coming out? Or I guess, where's the pipe going to come out exactly?
Which project are you
talking about? Now I'm talking about the Tanner Falls one.
I haven't been involved in that project at all.
All right.
It's not perched. Not legal.
There's no need to have public access over the pipe up on the larger project. There's already a road down to the river.
That was a requirement under our shoreline regulations to provide public access on the subdivision property to the shoreline.
It's already there.
It was also something that we heard a lot of comment from the public, that they wanted to see access.
And I support an improved kayak takeout point and parking point and changing point, even some latrines there. I support all of that. Support our kayak friends on the river. But this just seems like it's over the top, putting a trail on top of a pipe when there's already a road that goes down there. It's just ludicrous. My mind.
All right. Well, thanks for putting up with us, Mike.
Move to adjourn?
Yes. Second.
I'll second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed.
Good. Improved by more than aye.
Yeah, I know.
Pretty good.
Okay.